discouraging verse in all of the Bible to me. And the other is the most encouraging verse in the Bible to me as a parent. And the interesting thing is that both of them relate to discipline. You turn back in the Old Testament to 1 Samuel chapter 3. I want to focus your attention upon verse 13, but let me read verse 12 to get the context. God is speaking and he says, "In that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house, from the beginning even unto the end." Now note, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons did bring a curse upon themselves, and he restrained them not." Now may I remind you that Eli was a devoted priest, but he was a defective parent. And this tells me that it is altogether possible to be professionally successful and parentally a failure, even in the ministry of Jesus Christ, or spiritual things. Eli was not a bad man. Maybe he was too busy, even in the service of the Lord. And I want you to note that God scores him not for his ignorance, but for his indifference. He knew what the problem was, but he did nothing about it. He chose to look the other way, hoping perhaps that it would go away. And it didn't. And I don't know about you, but in my judgment, this is one of the most sobering verses to which my mind has ever been exposed. That it is possible for me, even in the ministry, to be successfully professionally and a failure as a parent, because of neglect, indifference, busyness, preoccupation. Now, let's turn over to the New Testament and breathe some fresher air. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7. "For God has not given us a spirit of fearfulness or frustration." Any frustrated parents here this morning? I find that a person's frustration as a parent is in direct proportion to the age of his children. For the first 12 years, you can do absolutely nothing wrong. And almost overnight, you are suddenly catapulted into the place where you can do nothing right. Your children condition you for 12 years. And then comes the blast. And I find an awful lot of parents of adolescents who are shot through with frustration. I got news for you. If this is your plight, you never got this from God, because he is not in the process of giving you a spirit of frustration. What does he give? Well, he gives three things without which discipline is an impossibility. First of all, he gives you power. The word translated in the Greek text is ability, enablement, equipment, resources. That which you need, but which you desperately do not have. That's what he specializes in. You come to the end of yourself, then you come to the beginning of God's resources. Inexhaustible supply. Secondly, he gives love, and that's the context for discipline. But this is supernatural love. This is the kind of love that you don't have. He's not talking about conditional love, loving a child on the basis of his performance. Talking about spiritual, unconditional love. Loving as Jesus Christ loves. Loving the unlovely. And the third ingredient that you need is a sound or a disciplined mind. You see, the secret of a disciplined child is a disciplined parent. Your basic problem is not the control of your child, it's the control of yourself. And if you're not under control, then you're in no position to control your children. And I find parents who literally hit the fan. They just blow their cool and cool. And they wonder why it is that the kid's climbing the wall and giving them all kinds of fits. I would say to anyone who is here who is in the process of experiencing the trauma of a child going through a period of rebellion, going through a period of reactionism, going through a period of resistance, my first and foremost counsel to you is pray that God will help you to keep your cool. If you blow it, then, my friend, you have nothing to give to your child. And this may give him the most severe test of whether your Christianity really works or not. Whether Jesus Christ can control you in the midst of an agonizing, frustrating, humanly hopeless situation. Now, I want to take this subject of discipline, and there is a great deal in the scriptures on the subject, but I'd like to expose it to one freighted portion in the Word of God. Will you turn, please, to Ephesians chapter 6? I want to underscore in your thinking verse 4. Now, it is a manifest fact that we are creatures of extremes. Walt stated it so clearly just a moment ago. Satan is the pusher of the pendulum. And he is always trying to get you to move in the direction of an extreme. Now let me show you how this works in the area of discipline. We have just emerged from a period of ultra-permissiveness in which under discipline was the order of the day. Don't lay a hand on that kid. You'll warp him. The kid wants to throw a brick through a plate glass window, let him throw it through because you don't want to curb his genius for throwing bricks. But don't touch it. Corporeal punishment, that's out. And unfortunately, some of you may have been reared on it. And if you have, you know better than anyone else what the penalty of this is. And if you have to teach in a seminary, as I do, you know it even better. Because I think the greatest curse in a person's life is to be the product of a home where there was no discipline. And the result is I have students who are brilliantly endowed, not only mentally, but spiritually. And they have tremendous motivation and drive. But they have no discipline. And he can't line this thing up. These are seriously handicapped individuals. Now, this was a reaction against a period that preceded it of over-discipline. So here's the peril of the pendulum. You know, prior to that, and again, some of you older people were probably the product of this. I mean, man, my father never asked me my opinion. He just gave an ultimatum. It was divine fire. He didn't call me twice. Once was the issue. And, you know, pushing it to its extreme, it was the type of thing, if a kid turns around, anytime he turns around, you nail him to the floor. You make a federal case out of every issue. You beat him to a pulp. And the straps and the woodshed were all a part of this regime. Somebody asked Grady Wilson some years ago, did your mother ever use the strap on you? He said, did she ever use the strap? She had a strap in the kitchen hanging under the motto, I need thee every hour. Spare not, spoil a child. This was it. Well, people said, man, this developed tremendous insecurity. And the result is, they swung over to here. Now, today, the evidence is in. And you know what the evidence is? That both of these extremes,
produce exactly the same product. They develop an insecure individual. Arbitrary over-discipline and subjective under-discipline produce exactly the same product.
I can take you to Harry Hines Boulevard in Dallas, where we have one of our juvenile facilities. And I will take you through that facility and interview and introduce you to every delinquent there, and you will find them classified in one of two groups. They either had parents who beat them to a pulp, or they had parents who never laid a hand on them, and there are no exceptions. I was out with a squad car one night in a juvenile detail, and the officer and I picked up a kid unconscious by the side of the road, and we counted 64 major welts on this kid's body. He had been beaten into unconsciousness by his father. And when we communicated with his father, the first thing his father wanted to tell us was, "I'm a disciplinarian." The truth of the matter is he doesn't know beans about discipline. Now, I want you to look in chapter 6 and verse 4 to see how the Lord preserves you from either the extreme of over-discipline or under-discipline. "And ye father." You say, why does he address this to fathers? My friend, for the same reason that he addresses the husband as the head of the home. This does not mean that the husband is to be cast into the exclusive role of a disciplinarian. I hear many a mother say, "You wait till your father comes home, we'll straighten that out." And that's tremendous expectation. We can hardly wait for a dad to come home. No, the truth of the matter is, one of the principles of discipline is that the punishment or corrective factor must be closely allied with the timing of the offense. And the truth of the matter is, the mother, particularly in the earlier years, will have to do a lot of the disciplining within a good family. The reason he addresses it to fathers is not that this is his exclusive role, but this is his responsibility. In other words, he may not do all of the disciplining, but he's responsible for all of the disciplining that is done. And if it is not done, he will never be able to palm it off and say, "Well, Lord, that's my wife's problem." And that creates a rather sobering responsibility for you as a man. In fact, the bulk of revelation in the scripture concerning children is addressed to fathers. And this is just one more evidence piling up that you cannot cop out as a man of your responsibility in the home. Now he says, "Provoke not your children to wrath." Now, this is a very interesting construction in the original language. It can be translated one of two ways. Either Paul was saying to the Ephesians, "Stop provoking your children to wrath," or he was saying, "Don't get the habit." And it's a beautiful command because it hits both types of individuals. In other words, if you're not doing it, don't ever form the habit. If you are, cut it out. Now, how do you provoke a child to wrath? You provoke a child to wrath by one of two means, either by over-discipline or by under-discipline. Let me give you an illustration of each. It's been a hard day at the office. And you lost a deal, and the boss reamed you out, you know, the whole picture. And you come home, and your lovely wife greets you at the door, gives you a wonderful kiss, invites you to sit down to the most delicious dinner. Your favorite items are included in it. Man, it's such a release to get into this haven where everybody loves you and appreciates you. And you finish the dinner, and you go over and get into the overstuffed chair, your favorite one, prop your feet up on the little stand, and you get the paper open to your favorite section, the sports page.
and you're just beginning to get involved, and a kid comes plowing right through the middle of the paper and says, "Hey, Daddy, look what I drawed." And man, you blow your cork. "Get out of here!" And the little kid runs off. But the next time, it takes a little longer for him to decide to come. And the next time, a little longer. Until by the time he's 12 years of age, he could care less. You know what you have done? You have provoked your child to wrath. You have essentially 12 years in which to build a bridge into the life of your child. And you cannot decimate those relationships for 12 years and try to build them in the next 12. I didn't say it's impossible, it's extremely difficult. How do you provoke your child to wrath but under discipline? I'm covered with this type of kid today because they came out of this permissive generation. Had a kid look me straight in the eye and say to me, "Prof, I never realized how much I was sold down the river by my family until I came here to the seminary." He said, "I have absolutely no self-discipline." You see, a child who lives in real life recognizes that freedom has fences. There is no such thing as being free to do anything you please. And if that's not developed within his home, then sooner or later he's going to come to the stark realization that he is an emotionally handicapped individual. Now look at the next part. Stop provoking your children to wrath, but nurture them. Bring them up in two things: the chastening and the admonition of the Lord. Now, these words are very critical. Every doctor practices two forms of medicine. He practices preventive medicine, and he practices corrective medicine. And every parent instructed in the Word of God practices two kinds of discipline: corrective discipline and preventive discipline. The word chastening embraces the corrective aspects. The word admonition embraces the preventive aspects. And let's see if I can diagram this for you to show you the relationship. Allow the circle at the center to represent the corrective aspect, and the entire box to represent the preventive aspect. What this passage is saying to you, in effect, is this: you have no right to correct your child unless you play with him. Well, you say, "I can do anything I want, I'm his parent." Absolutely. You can beat him to a pulp. But you can't get the results you want. And what you do in terms of playing with your child will largely determine what the value of your corrective influence is. Let me give you an illustration. My two boys and I love to wrestle. It's a little embarrassing anymore because they're getting awfully big. But when they were small, we used to have terrific wrestling matches, and my wife is a rather strange individual because she does not appreciate our wrestling in the living room. Now, it's hard for me to embrace a feminine mentality at this point because this is such a significant activity, obviously. But she would toss us out of the living room, and we'd get out in the backyard, and we'd get ourselves going in a terrific wrestling match. And some time ago, my younger son, Bill, got me into a hole. So I decided I was going to use this as a teaching opportunity to teach him how to break the hole. And what I did was take his arm, which was pinning around me, and I simply used a lot of leverage like this, but I really used too much leverage. And when I threw him around, he went tearing across the yard, you know, and you go like this because you can almost see the concussion taking place as this kid bounces on the ground across the yard. Oh, I've done it. I've ruined him for life. He bounces over on the yard and gets up and says, "Boy, Dad, that was terrific. Do it again." And the interesting thing is that's the same kid that I can take and go like this. And he dissolves in tears. What's the difference? The difference is a difference of relationship. When you go like that and a kid dissolves in tears because you are the person he loves because you play with him. And therefore, when you correct him, you come on like horseback. This involves talking, I think more important, listening. And if you want to learn how to do this, you talk to my wife because she's the authority. She's taught me everything I know. I am a talker. That's what I'm paid to do. Not much, but... And my wife has taught me the most important lessons I've ever learned in my life. And that is a lesson of coming home from seminary where I've been talking and teaching all day long or in a conference and going into my teenage gal's room and throwing myself across the bed and saying, "Hey, babe, what happened today?" And she knows all of the high-powered things that are going on down at the high school and Jill at home, you know, things far more important than what's taking place in the United Nations or outer space. All of the big deals. And the interesting thing is, it's as a result of this listening that your child hears what you say in corrective discipline. The reason he listens so little to what you say is that you listen so little to what he says. My youngest boy was playing in a sand pile a number of years ago right outside of my bedroom window. There's a little kid that lives down the street who plays with him. Did play with him a great deal when he lived there. And they're both playing together in a sandbox, and all of a sudden I hear this unearthly voice, "Johnny!" Johnny never moved. And Bill says, "Hey, Johnny, your mommy's calling you." He says, "Yeah, I know. Call number 2, 3, 4, Bob." We finally got to the Lazarus call. Man, alive. The decibel level on that was so great, I thought the pain was going to go out. "Johnny!" And just as dispassionately as all get out, Johnny turns to Bill and says, "I got to go now." And I thought to myself, that kid is brilliant. You know what he is? He's a student of his mother. And he knows when she means it. How many times do you ask your child to do something? He doesn't listen to her, and I'll tell you why. It's perfectly obvious. He never listens to him. Very, very important that you listen to what a child says. In fact, that's exactly why your child asks you what you think are stupid questions. "Mommy, what's my name?" You're acting like your father again. If he is, his father is a brilliant individual. Because you know what he's really asking for? He's not asking for information. He's asking for fellowship. He's asking for this great big adult to come down and say, "Billy." And he smiles all over and takes off because he's gotten your ear. And I think the greatest thing you could ever do for your children in the midst of your high-powered washing operations and ironing and rearranging the dust and all of the other profound operations in which you engage with that junk business you've got under one market. The most important thing in all of the world for you is to listen to your child. It's one reason why, in my judgment, the most critical time for a woman to be in a home is when that child comes home from school. And if I had to work or I had to do other things, I tried to work everything around that particular time. So when that kid walks in, where he's been knocked all over the lot out in the real life, where the bullets are real, he walks in the front door and there's the most wonderful, loving, warm, understanding, listening mother, who somehow hears everything that I say. You know, I never had this in my life, and I suppose this is one reason why I appreciate it so much in my wife and what she has taught me. All I had was an Eskimo dog. But you know, my most vivid memories of that dog are talking to us. You know? I lived in a hell on earth. My most vivid memories are absolutely criminal to this day. The most wonderful thing God ever provided for me, as I look back, was a dog. And I used to tell him of all of my problems. And you know the thing? He never gave me any grief. He would always listen. Tears would be coming down my face, and he'd lick up. I always thought somehow that Liz always knew, always understood. You know what I became? A parent. My wife and I, in fact, were discussing this last night before we retired. And I was asking, how in the world did I ever get off on this home bed? Because I don't come from the kind of home that produces what I'm telling you. But you know, my grandmother told me that the most vivid memory she had of my early childhood was when I was about 4 years of age, getting down on my knees in her presence and praying that God would give me a Christian home. And this is a good thing for some of you who came out of a non-Christian home. Because there are advantages. God overrules in this type of thing. And I'll tell you the one thing he does. He makes you know, friend, what you don't want. And I had hell wall to wall in my home. The only one thing I knew going into my marriage is, friend, I knew what I didn't want. I don't think I would ever take a drop of liquor if the scriptures had nothing to do with it because of what I saw it do in my family. Never been even a slight problem to me. I get sick and nauseated just at the smell of the stuff. For my most vivid memories as a kid are bringing a grandfather out of a tavern in Philadelphia so I could get him home before he shot all of the paycheck during the Depression. And I go from one tavern to another picking up pretzels. What I'm saying, my friend, is that this contest, you fix the kid's bicycle, you take him for a walk, or maybe a drive with him, you got to go over to the store and pick up something, don't go alone, take him along. You elected, you are so important to me, son, I want your company. And one thing I used to tell my children over and over again is that I would rather spend time with you than any other person on earth. I just enjoy your fellowship so much. Talk to me some more. And the greatest event of the summer will come in just 2 weeks. And that is when my entire family is home and we're going to sit down and we're going to have us a ball rehearsing what Jesus Christ has been doing in the life of my children. Chicago and Tyler and Denison and in Dallas. And we'll sit down and see what God is doing with it. But you see, this is the context. Now what has he done here is determined by what you do out here. And the more you build preventively into the life of your child through these things which are significant to him, the more you accomplish through your corrective. In fact, I am quite convinced the average child is far more concerned to please you than you ever understand. He really wants to please you. And sometimes I think we really make it harder for them to accomplish their objective instead of easier. All right, let's take some of these principles and relate it to your experience. We talked about the revelation of Christian discipline. Let me give you some requisites for Christian discipline, and I'd like to divide this into two areas, negative and positive. There are two words I'm always careful never to use. Those words are always and never. But I would like to suggest some things you ought always never use. Number one. Never use comparison with other children. I say, Billy, why aren't you good like Bobby? Well, there's one intelligent answer to that. I'm not Bobby. And I never cease to be amazed, even to this day, that I have four children, all the product of the same combination of genes, and no two of them are in any way alike. I cannot discipline any of my children in exactly the same way. I can't motivate them in the same way. I have one son. If I say to that guy, is that the best you can do, man? That guy will come right up out of the rock. I have another child. If I said, is that the best you could do, that may be the last thing they do. And what we're looking for is some patent medicine approach to discipline and child rearing, and there is none. And there is none for the simple reason that God wants to keep you a dependent individual, seeking his wisdom, because that's the way you grow. And never forget, God gave you children, not in order for you to help them to grow, but in order for them to help you to grow. Making any progress? And so he gives you different kinds of children. And boy, you got one, you know, and man, the thing is all coming out just exactly according to specs, and you think, man, we got it under the ball, and the next one comes along. You know, and everything you try is a bummer. And you go, what in the world happened? Are you mine? Yeah, that's what bothers you most about your kids. They remind you so much of yourself. You say, why are you like that? Because you're my father, is the intelligent answer. You're my mother. And you know, if you stop to think for a moment, every time you teach a child to compare himself with others, you are teaching him the most unscriptural principle of Christian experience, and that's to keep your eye on other people. And the one thing we would not allow in our family is anybody saying, yeah, but Bob does it. This just never cuts ice. This is totally unacceptable. The real issue is, what does God want you to do? I have a colleague, Dr. Campbell. He and I are very close friends. We were in Wheaton together. I was the senior class president one year. He was the senior class president the next year. So he wrote to me, how's Dallas? I said, it's great. So he came down to Dallas. And we've been very close friends. And we have children who are quite close in age. And the interesting thing is, you know, Bob will come home and say, well, Dr. Campbell's kids do it. And then I talk to Dr. Campbell, and lo and behold, he says, well, Dr. Hendrick's kids do it. Because the kids are sharp as a whip putting these two things together. And you know, it's a wonderful thing, my friends. Can I give you just something in passing that occurred to me? It's a wonderful thing to teach your children that we do what we do or don't do what we don't do on one basis, and that's the basis of the leadership of the Spirit in our life, not on the basis of the Christian community. See, I got a lot of people who are patterning their lives after the Christian community, and my friend, the Christian community is going to pot. My standard isn't the Christian community, it's Jesus Christ. Secondly, oh, yes. Don't use scorn or ridicule. Now, if you are of the male of the species, you are a master at this. The man is an artist at sarcasm. He walks in the front door and says, well, wife, what are we having today for a burnt offering? Ha, ha, ha. And let's suppose he's trying to develop his wife, who is not exactly a Betty Crocker. This is exactly the way to accomplish it, isn't it? She just comes right up out of the chair with tremendous motivation to be the finest cook in the world. As a man, I've often thought, if I were married and some guy came home with that, I think I'd take the egg and crack it over his head and say, you carried the ball. That's a male viewpoint. Why God didn't make you that way. And you allow it to infect your relationship in your home. Most of you would never, never, never say to me what you have said to your wife, the person you love more than anyone else in all the world. So you're very polite to me, very gracious to me. You always say yes, sir, and no, sir, and thank you, and please, except with your wife. Many of us have said things to our children we would never say to anyone else in the world, and certainly not the way we said them. You get down to the office and you're the most polite guy in the office. Everybody says, man alive, woo! Well, the girls start flowering over you because, oh boy, there's the gentleman of the office. Then you go home and, and the woman, you know, boy, out at the church, woo, my, she's the paragon of graciousness. But at home, let me give you an extreme illustration in order that you may see it. We had a student at the seminary some time ago who had about 147 IQ, which is slightly above average, for your information. He also had an older sister who had 155.
His father has a PhD degree. His mother has two master's degrees. When the second child came along, with only 147, something of a dunce, in the process of learning how to speak, he started to stammer and stutter. Very normal. But this was a blow to a PhD and to a woman with two master's degrees. It was really a blow to their pride to think that people of our intellectual capacity would have a child that stuttered. So every time the child would stutter or stammer, you know what they would do? They would make fun of him. He would, and so they talk back to him in the same way. Until you know what they have been successful in doing? They have been successful in driving this in so far that three prominent speech pathologists in Dallas are all convinced separately that this is a hopeless, incurable case. Now, how would you like to have a son who was called to the ministry where you are paid to speak? He's your son. He's called to the ministry, and a guy can't say one sentence without getting hopelessly hung up. And then back off and realize you were the one who had the distinction of developing him into this kind of a limited person. Now, the interesting thing is that every one of you can see this in the extreme. What you cannot see is what you are doing every day to develop exactly the same thing. Every time you are primarily critical of your child when you ought to be commending, you are developing an emotional cripple. And what you ought to do is to run a tape recorder in your home. That is what you hear over and over again. And you ask yourself, how many times did I say, thank you, son. I'm so proud of you. How many times did you say, man, do I ever appreciate effort like that? The kid put everything he had into it. It's still not up to par in terms of your ultimate standard. In terms of his capabilities right now, it's tremendous. If you want to develop an area of weakness in your child, I'll tell you a guaranteed way to develop it into an area of strength, and that is commend him every legitimate time you can, rather than criticize him. Third, don't use withdrawal of affection or attention. Johnny, don't do that. Mommy won't love you. Ooh, you are selling your love too cheaply. It's in a bargain basement sale. Your real problem is that you've got conditional love. And I love my children no matter what they do. I do not always like what they do. But I love them. You see, Christ accepts you just as you are, not on the basis of your good works. And the reason I seek to please the Lord is not because I'm trying to earn brownie points, but because I'm so much in love with him that I want to please him. Ask yourself if that's the motivation you're giving to your child. Third, don't use promise of rewards or bribes. You may eliminate the problem now, but you'll create a greater one later. One of the interesting things in travel is that you get into all kinds of homes. And I have some very interesting experiences. I was in a home some time ago where the father said, well, let's get the Bible for family worship. Got the Bible, you know, and opened the thing. And I was watching Dennis the Menace sitting across from me. Sure enough, boy, it perked out. He finally looked. He says, hey, Dad, what in the world are we doing this for? Well, I think if he'd been closer, the guy'd have pulverized him. I was in a home some time ago. It's a real attractive, bright-eyed little kid sitting across from me who would wink at me every now and then. And we were obviously communicating with our eyes, if no other way. And finally, Mom put on her dish 5 times as many mashed potatoes as I can eat. And that's saying something. Then we started what I call Operation Rhubarb. Sally, eat your mashed potatoes. Sally, eat your mashed potatoes. Sally, eat your mashed potatoes.
Sally, won't you please eat your mashed potatoes for Mommy?
Sally, if you don't eat your mashed potatoes, you aren't going to get any dessert. And I'm watching Sally like a hawk. And sure enough, she's sweating it out. Pretty soon we cart off the dish and Mom brings in a double dessert. And little Sally looks across and I said, you know, Sally's more brilliant than her mother. She's a student of her mother. And her mother is obviously not too much of a student of her.
Every time you say to a child, look, if you do this, I'll give you a lollipop,
then what you're doing is creating a greater problem. Because when you become adults, nobody gives lollipops for mowing front lawn. My wife has never given me a lollipop. Isn't that a shame? I got to do the sad thing twice a week. Now that my kids are all gone, nobody left to do it but me.
You see, what you're trying to do is develop internal discipline and desire. It doesn't come by these external rewards. And then, don't discipline when angry.
I always remember this one vividly because a dear lady came up at the conclusion of a workshop I had. She said, of all of the stupid things I've ever heard, that takes the cake.
Don't discipline when angry. Why, man, I can't discipline unless I'm angry. I got to work up a lather.
And so we talked for a while, and it was perfectly obvious that before long she was saying to me, but I'm really not getting anywhere.
See, because you hit them harder and harder till finally you break your hand. So you get yourself a paddle, and pretty soon you break the paddle.
But all the time you're not getting your objectives accomplished. Because as we saw in our little diagram, this has nothing to do with the force or even the nature of the punishment. It has everything to do with the context. And I have often said to a parent, my friend, if you're not under control, I'll tell you what I'd suggest you do. I'd suggest you forget the discipline now. And go into your room and get down on your knees and ask the Spirit of God to get control of you. And when you are completely controlled, very sober, you understand exactly what you're doing and why, then walk into the child's room to administer the discipline. And you will be amazed to see the difference in results. By the way, this is why the number one problem in family rearing today is child beating. This is the one number one reason why the average kid gets hit in the worst place in all the world to hit a kid, and that's in the back of the head. Because the average guy, the moment the kid goes into action and does something, he whips around and clips him like this across the back of the head, the closest thing to him. And he's really not under control. He's not at all thinking of what he's doing, or he would never do this. And certainly not why he's doing what he's doing. And then the last one I want to suggest in negatives, never expect perfection. One of my great concerns about the Christian home today is that it is suffering from what I call a suffocating fog of moralism. And the result is you major on minors in your home. And you are expecting a child to do what the child is totally incapable of doing. Obviously, you want to have standards. But in the process of setting goals and standards, don't frustrate him. Because that just aggravates his problem as well as yours. What you're trying to do is to motivate him. And what I'm looking for is not perfection. I'm looking for progress. And by the way, that's what your child is looking for in you. He's not looking for a perfect parent. I hope you're not trying to project that on him. He'll never get the message. What you are trying to produce is the realization that Jesus Christ is making a difference in my life. All right, let's come over on the positive side. I'd like to suggest a few things that you ought to do. The first thing I'd suggest to you is to impart the expectancy of obedience. Some of us never expected and were seldom disappointed. Impart the expectancy of obedience. I think the Lord brought an experience into my life some time ago which helped to bring this into focus. At a number of times, I have worked as a consultant for the juvenile department of the city of Dallas, and I've had some choice opportunities since I work on a volunteer basis and without pay. I have no strings attached. And they sent me out on a case, and I went to the shack, and it was an August hot afternoon like it is right now in Dallas, about 103, 104, and I'd been out on a number of calls. And the delinquent involved came to the door. He's about 14 years of age. And he recognized me, and he invited me to come in, invited me to have a seat on the sofa, if you could call it that. And then he asked me, "Would you like a drink of water?" I said, "Boy, buddy, I sure would. That's so thoughtful of you. I really appreciate that." So the kid disappears, and he gets a peanut butter jar with some peanut butter left in it. And he fills it up with water. And he comes back, and just as he walked into the room to give me this dirty glass of peanut butter water, Mom shows up, and she hit the fan. She came unglued. She reamed that kid out. She cussed him as I've seldom heard a man curse an individual. And of course the kid was, you know, so traumatized in the process that he stumbled over this little beat up rug in front of the divan, and the whole thing right down the front of me. And man, she clipped him and cussed him and drove him out of the room. She said, "That kid can't do anything right." I said, "You know, lady, I hate to start this interview on a negative note, but I couldn't disagree with you more. I said, I'm proud of your son. Proud of him. Look at the water all over you." I said, "How many young people do you know of his age who are so thoughtful that they would invite me to come in and sit down? So thoughtful and considerate that they would go get me a glass of water. Yeah, look at that dirty water and look where it is now." I said, "Lady, did you ever make a mistake?" She said, "He can't do anything wrong." I said, "As long as you continue to say he can't, he won't." Now you ask yourself the question, do you believe in your child? What do you project to him, that he or she is a problem or he or she is a potential? Do you expect him to obey, or do you say, "Well, that's par for the course. What else do you expect?" And he seldom disappoints you. I have often said to a parent, "My friend, your first task is to get on your boy or girl's team. You ought to be right on the front section of the cheering. Front row of the cheering section. Just yelling your head off with excitement." Secondly, help your child to evaluate his disobedience. Now, that rubs pretty hard because, you see, that will take something out of you. See, it's a lot easier to hit a kid than it is to take some time to sit down with them and say, "Hey, buddy, we really got fouled up again, didn't we? How are we going to get out of this one? How are we going to keep from getting into it the next time? Let's see if we can plan a better way." That takes time. That takes thought. That takes a lot of creativity. And many times I think this is what we're not willing to invest in a child. Third, allow the child to express his own viewpoint. So much of discipline is really arbitrary. It's a blow to your pride, and therefore you move into action. But you haven't really thought through all of the issues. I teach a wives class at the seminary. It happens to come on Thursday night, my hardest day, because Thursday is also faculty meeting. And in this particular year, I taught three classes on that day, plus an innocuous faculty meeting, plus the wives' challenging teaching session, which to me is one of the most important classes I teach at the seminary. And I got home about 9:15, a lot of counseling in between. Boy, I mean, I was whipped. And I felt like I'd been drawn through a keyhole. And I walked through the front door, and here are my two boys, you know, in a rhubarb, clear case of homicide. And so, you know, I go into action. Obviously, the older boy is the responsible one, so I discipline him. And I walk into the bedroom, and my lovely wife says, "Sweetheart, you missed." It's a wonderfully encouraging statement. I said, "I missed. How did I miss?" She said, "Let me tell you what happened before you came." And then she filled me in on the total picture, which completely changed the dynamics. So I had to do what I think is the hardest thing for any parent to do. I had to go to my child and apologize. You ever have to do this? You ought to do it. It'll do something for you. To say nothing of your child. And my boy was whimpering, and he was doing the dishes, and I went out, and I put my arm around him. I said, "Bob, I'm very sorry. I said, I acted too hastily. I really didn't know all that was involved, and I'm very sorry. And I want to apologize. I said, will you forgive me?" I can still see him say, "Sure, Dad." Puts his arm around me. He said, "That's okay. We all make mistakes." I think back on this thing, I don't know how many hundreds of times. We all make mistakes. The problem is that sometimes what we're trying to do is to present ourselves as the perfect parent who never makes the mistake. I had a lady come to one of my classes teaching the Christian home, and man, did she ever come through loud and clear. She has five tremendous kids. I just enjoy, my wife and I enjoy spending time in this home. Real life kids, not Dresden dolls, but people. Every one of these kids has a tiger in his tank, and it just grabs me to be around them. I feel sorry for myself. I go over to visit them. And she came into my class, and a student asked her a question on a panel, and I'll never forget her explanation. She said, "Well, sir, I remember when my oldest daughter was about 16 and was so put out with the decision I made concerning the car that particular night." And she said, "I got her in the bedroom, and I sat down with her, and I said to her, 'Phil, I want you to know that you're the first teenager I've ever had. I've never been down this road before. And I'm quite sure that I'm making some mistakes. But I want you to know that I love you. And if I make any mistake, it will be because I don't understand what to do, but not because I don't want to do the right thing.'" You know, I think the students just about fell off the edge of the chair. Because, my friend, that is profound insight to communicate. And the interesting thing is the child's reaction becomes vastly different. Because the week following, I invited this young girl to come to our class, who is now married. And without her knowing anything about what her mother had said, she cited this as one of the critical experiences in her entire life that marked her and her relationship with her mother. Because she said, "I have an honest mother. Not a perfect one, but an honest one." And that says worlds to a kid, because as you know, they despise phoniness. All right, here's another one. Remember, the goal of obedience is not outward conformity, but inward conviction and control. And this is what will change your whole ball game. Because you know what I found? I've discovered it's very easy to get outward conformity, at least to a certain age. You make a kid do anything you want. It's easy for the mother to go over and say, "Son, sit down." "No." "Don't sass me, sit down." "No." And she goes over and grabs him. "Now you'll sit down." He says, "That's right, Mom, I'm sitting down on the outside, but I'm standing up on the inside." And you know, we're covered with kids who will do all of the right things on the outside, but on the inside, they're covered over with resentment. Sure, he goes to church. He goes to church because he's got a 45 in his head. I want a kid who goes to church because he wants the fellowship with Jesus Christ and hear what God has to say in his word to him as a person. How do you get this type of thing? I'll tell you, you don't get it by constant outward conformity only, without developing any inward conviction. Otherwise, what you're doing is lid sitting. You know what happens when you sit on a lid? I'll tell you. The harder you sit on a lid, the harder you hold that lid down, the higher it's going to go when you take your hand off it. And if you don't believe me, you just go to any Christian college in America and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. I've seen rebels on a Christian college campus that will put the average rebel on a university campus in the shade.
And the reason is, boy, here I am now. Mom and Dad don't tell me to go to church. Wheaton College, they took a survey some time ago. The largest amount of water used in the dormitory between 11 and 12 o'clock on Sunday morning. See, a Christian college. Oh, Christian college, you go to church, do you? What do? Come around and flush them out of the room? Get the shotgun here. It's time to go to church. You love to go to church, don't you?
And the same thing could be true in any other. Don't score Wheaton, my friend. I'll clue you. This is not an exception.
What I'm trying to do is to get a kid
who basically is going to make decisions on the basis of what's right, what's wrong, and what does the Lord want me to do in my life. See, the object of rearing a boy, for example, is not to rear a good boy. We've got some of the finest boys you've ever seen at 42.
Your job is to rear a good man. And the process of rearing a good man is the process of moving from complete dependency to complete independence. And that is a process. You have to feed this to a child over a period of time. Last one I want to suggest for you, and then we'll see if we have some time for some questions. Remember, the discipline is a long-range program. You know how you should learn that? You should learn that if you ever learn to play checkers. I used to fashion myself to be a champion checker player. There was an older man in the community who was purported to be. I was convinced the reason he was is that he hadn't played me. So I hung around him one day and he'd have too much traffic. He said, "Hey, son, how would you like to play checkers?" Man, tremendous. So we set up the checkers on a board. He said, "Okay, you go first." I said, "Great, we established the pattern of the game." We exchanged several moves. Pretty soon he fed me a checker. He said, "Jump me." I jumped and he fed me another checker. "Jump me." And a third, and I thought, man, this is easier than I thought. And you know, as if it happened yesterday, I can still see a little puff on his pipe, a little wry smile break out on his face as he took a checker and went, "King me. King me. How in the world did he get over there?" And would you believe it, my friend? With one king, he wiped every checker I had off that board. That's when my liberal arts education began in playing checkers. See, no good checker player minds losing a couple checkers if you know where you're going. Did you lose some checkers last week? In your home? The question is, where are you going? "Oh, a lady came running down to the seminary, told my secretary I've got to have an appointment with Dr. Henderson. It's got to be today." And so she sandwiched it in between something else, and she walks into my office and she says, "Professor, my child is a pervert." And she just cried like crazy. I said, "How old is your child?" "Oh, he's 4 years of age." I said, "What happened?" "Oh, he ran into the bathroom where my daughter was undressed. And he actually enjoyed it." And I said, "You know, I got wonderful news for you." She said, "You do?" I said, "You got the most normal person that has ever been created. It's a very creative, exploratory person. But you know what you do? You take an isolated experience like this and you extend it. He's going to be a pervert because you see it in isolation rather than in relation." The interesting thing is I can go around here to people who have older children and they'll tell you exactly the same thing happened. This is a normal part of growing up. I had two school teachers, the only two I ever remember. One was my fifth grade teacher, the other was my sixth grade teacher. My fifth grade teacher was Miss Simon. Very appropriately named. Oh, boy, she was a beast out of the sea. She hated my you-know-what. She tied me to my seat with a rope, with my hands behind my back like this, because every time she'd go out of the room, I'd go into action. She took mucilage paper, she started around here, went all the way around to the back, and I'd sit there like this. She'd say, "Now, Howard, you will sit still and keep quiet." Well, what else do you do under these circumstances? And finally, I was graduated, for obvious reasons, from her class. And I went to my sixth grade teacher. She was Miss Nellie, 6 feet, 4 inches tall, with a beautiful gray head. I used to think she was sort of a feminine version of Sherlock Holmes. And I thought if that dear woman had done nothing except stand erect, she would have done something for you.
But I remember my first encounter with her because I walked into the classroom and she said, "Oh, your name is Howard Hendricks." She said, "I've heard a lot about you." And I thought, here we go. But she said, "I don't believe a word of it." You know, my friends, that woman threw down a challenge to me the likes of which I had never had in my life up to that point. I met the first woman who ever convinced me she believed in me, and I never let her down. I would knock myself out in that woman's class, I can still remember, working like crazy at the desk to get this thing in and taking extra work and banging it out all the time. I'd catch a glimpse over at the window, a little pane of glass in it, and there framed in it was Miss Simon, my fifth grade teacher. She'd just come to see this thing which has come to pass. There he is, sitting, clothed, and in his right mind. You know, I've often thought back to this, my friends, because I asked, what's the difference? I'll tell you, one lady saw me as a problem, and the other saw me as a potential. The interesting thing is to see what happened in the church that I attended. It celebrated its 40th anniversary some time ago and invited me to come back and preach at the banquet they had. I'll never forget it. After I got through, dear women came up. "Oh, Howard, we're so proud of you." I didn't say anything, you understand. I'm a very gracious person. But I had the strongest urge to say, "Really, lady, you didn't help at all." Because I can count on that hand the people who ever saw me anything than a problem in that church. And by the way, there's some of you who are working with young people. And the greatest thing you can ever communicate is that you see a kid as a person in whom you have confidence. Because you see him not in terms of what he is, but in terms of what he can become. If you ever communicate that to a child, to a young person, you will communicate the most important thing you could possibly share with them. "I believe in you. You are a significant person. God is going to use you." And if not, you will communicate exactly the opposite. Now, I'll take just a few minutes and open it up for some questions. I hope we'll have more time tomorrow as we did in our last session. While you're thinking of one or two, tomorrow I think I will do the same thing as I did before, and that is I'd like to share with you some basic principles on how to rear a good marriage partner. And then at the end, we'll open it up for questions. But maybe you have one or two you'd like to fire away with. Yeah.
In one of your members, he said, "Do not use the promise of reward of God." I'm thinking specifically of reward. I know I work for reward.
Yeah, and I think most of us do. But you know the best kind of reward that you can communicate? And that's the reward of a job well done. In other words, it's what Walt was talking about this morning, and I thought in a new relationship, and that is your basic appeal from the scriptures is not to compare yourself with someone else because they have different gifts, but to compare yourself with yourself. Now, if this kid begins to compare himself with himself, then he develops the highest reward system known in the process of motivation. And it is, I do this because I am rewarded myself. It's a job well done. Not because somebody gives me a star or a week at camp, etc. Now, I'm not suggesting that you may not use the others. Just use it by your own discretion. I'm saying, as far as I am concerned, with the people I work with, it to me is very low on my priority list. But if I can ever get the guy motivated in terms of rewarding himself, he'll never stop. He'll just keep on going.
Once you discipline a child, a young child, and he wants to come to you for some loving, or affection, should you give it to him?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I lather the kid with kisses.
Even right after.
Because remember, he's learning to differentiate that what you are doing correctly is in view of an altogether different object than what you are doing. Presentable. See, restore the fellowship after obedience. This is what the Lord does, doesn't he? That's your pattern. And he doesn't say, "Okay, buddy, you're off for 5 days. In 6 days, come back in prayer. I'll be ready to accept you."
And I think the same thing is true with the relationship with the child.
Yes, ma'am. How do you balance that out with the law about even sin, your just rewards from the Lord, even though we confess?
That's right. And he will see the same thing. Let me see if I can give you an illustration. I'm not sure if I use this with this group or not. I have so many groups here I'm talking to. I forget where I'm using some of it. One of my basic principles of teaching, whether it's teaching at the seminary level or teaching in my home, is that there is a law of expected result that you cannot overcome. Paul put it this way, whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. You sow tares, what are you going to reap? Wheat? No, exactly what you sow. And the truth of the matter is that's exactly what's going to happen to him. I had a kid with a paper route. I kept saying to him, Bob, watch the draw. Any of you guys have somebody throwing a paper out? Some of you have been with it. You know what I'm talking about. The only person who ever gets penalized is the kid throwing the paper. The customer never loses it. The company never loses it. The only guy to get the axe is the kid throwing the paper. So I said, look, buddy, you got to watch that drawer because you overdraw it. We're going to go to the cleaners. The end of 1 month, he lost $64. You ever throw a paper route for 30 days, getting up at 4 o'clock every morning, and at the end of it, you not only don't have any money, you're in the hole. That's exactly what happened. And you know what? I wouldn't pay it. He paid it. That's what I call the law of expected results. And I don't obviate that. In other words, let it go through. The interesting thing in a case like that is a child at that time needs very little punishment. He's got all of the punishment he can manage. I'll give you another experience, because many of you people tend to think in terms of what I am now instead of the process of coming up and what my kids are now. Somebody says, man, they're going to be at dinner table. Says, man, it must be fantastic to have a kid with the kind of ministry you got. I tell you, I don't know of anybody. I mean, anybody in Christian work who motivates me as much as my son does. This guy's got me stretching, hoofing like crazy for the pace he set. Well, let me tell you some things in root. Let me tell you the time when he not only lost the $64, but this was in a part of a constellation at the time, when he flunked chemistry in the honors section. So all year he's given me other reports of what's taking place. But, you know, he can't bring the F home, so he changes it on the report card to a D. And I said, well, we sort of bombed out. Then, yeah, Dad, but boy, he said, you don't know this course. In fact, there were only four people who got A's, and, you know. And, man, I really had to work to get that D out. Oh, boy, I really, it's really a miracle. In fact, he said, I think the Lord helped me. I said, well, you really think you did your best? Yeah, I really think I did my best. Said, okay, pal, that's what we expect. You're satisfied with it? So am I. That night, the professor called me up. This is Mr. Hendricks. He said, I got something bugging me I got to share with you. He said, I'm so sorry I had to flunk your son in chemistry. I said, you mean D's are now flunked? No, he didn't get a D. He got an F. And he said, I think so much of Bob. And he said, we're a very close personal friend, and I want you to know it's nothing personal with him or personal with you, but he just didn't do the work, and I had to flunk him. So you, what? You know, go through the whole routine. My wife will tell you the number one impression of our life with Bob, right from year one to the end, was the night when this finally dawned on him that we knew he had flunked. And it was a series of about three or four things that happened like this in a row. He was caught lying, all of the rest of it. And he just dissolved in our arms and said, how can you love me when I've disgraced you like I have? Now, the interesting thing is that Bob walked in here and I asked him to tell you about this thing. He would tell you again that this was a very determinative, crucial point in his life. It was the point at which he discovered he could no longer run from it. Now, what does he need? He needs tremendous punishment. He's covered over with it. What he really needs now is this forgiveness and love and acceptance to know, okay, buddy, what are we going to do from here on out? How do we make it? And I think it's this balance type of thing. Now, I think that this type of corrective punishment, I'm talking in terms of, let's say, the physical aspect, is only effective with the younger child. But I'll give you a concrete illustration. People say, when do you spank a child? I never spank a child for making a mistake. Like this kid that spilled the water. See, his motive was perfect. He just tripped over the rug because his mom was shouting at him. What would you do? As time goes on, obviously there are others. It's the teenager who's grounded for 2 weeks without the use of the car. That's easy. Take 5 with him. And kind of says, that's much more effective. And that talks his language. I mean, this is life. And you let the consequences go by in terms of it. But that doesn't mean that tomorrow we don't go play ball. See, the other keeps carrying on in terms of it, of its effects with him. Yeah. That'll have to be the last question.
About expected results on the one hand, and about the other not, you know, never do for a child what they can do for themselves. Well, we have to be parents of teenagers. And the best time, you know, I can remember the time when they went to bed. And
you're in a different league now.
So, where do rules fit into this? In other words, we take the position that we need a bedtime rule, and if they need sleep a certain amount of it, we think last year that this was part of their problem.
Right.
Now they should be able to go to bed by themselves. What is it? So we have a rule with expected results, and they talk, you know. But is this them, are doing something for them that they can do for themselves?
No, I think that this is where you are providing the balance element of encouraging them to do for themselves. What you're trying to do is to get the kid to get the pattern where he recognizes, I got to get sleep. That's what you're trying to develop. In the process, when he can't do it on his own, you extend trust to the extent that he's able to carry it. And if not, you keep bringing it back. And when he starts moving out in this way, we keep extending the trust. Which is why you have some parents, you know, you say, what? How in the world do you do this? You tell the kid he can do this, he can do that. I never let him do that. No, because you're not able to trust him as yet. He hasn't developed to that point of maturity where you can give him that much. Amazing thing is that I can give a kid a credit card, and I absolutely can tell you what the kid will do with a credit card because I've been down that road that much. I've also been down a road where we ran up $67 in a month on a credit card when I probably extended too much privilege too soon, before he was really capable of managing it. What it turned out to be was the most terrific means of teaching it. But the tuition on the experience was a little high, especially for Pop.